Hello, it's Vanessa Garrity, and we're at the end of the day for the Tune Project event in Newcastle, where we've been hearing the findings from the research that's been looking at the pathways around amphetamine use from a variety of perspectives. And it's been a really interesting afternoon, very well attended, a range of different perspectives and really interesting points. And if you want to follow that, if you look at the hashtag, which is hashtag Attune Project for all the latest, and we'll be uploading podcasts later. I'm here now with Amy O'Donnell, who was the research lead for the Attune Project. So, Amy, hi.
Hi, Vanessa. Hello.
For people who are listening online who couldn't be here today, could you just give people a little bit of background to the Attune Project and what it was about?
Okay, yes. Well, the project was funded by the National Institute of Health Research, but we were part of a much broader initiative, a European area research network around illicit substances, that was financing work to really try and unpick some of the unanswered questions around long-term use of amphetamine-type stimulants.
Yeah.
We were one of five countries, so alongside the UK, there was Germany, Poland, the Netherlands, and the Czech Republic. And the UK study is really focused on amphetamine use in the north of England.
Yeah.
Just to, I guess, give a bit of definition what we mean by amphetamine use. It's an umbrella term, but it covers generally about kind of four different types of substances. Yeah. So we're looking at amphetamines themselves, so speed, if you like, methamphetamine, crystal meth, ecstasy or MDMA. But we were also really interested in the phenomenon of novel psychoactive substances, stimulant types of those, which we know is an increasing issue in the UK and other parts of the world. And another phenomenon that we wanted to explore was around misuse of prescribed stimulants.
Yeah.
So we know, particularly among student populations, that there's a lot of misuse of things like Ritalin amongst that group. And we were interested in really kind of probing what are the reasons around around that.
Is that in terms of people using Ritalin to help them with the studies and things like that? And attention deficit, obviously, as well.
It was, although, I mean, we've heard today that sometimes people who've kind of started off using Ritalin sometimes then progress to using illicit stimulants once that prescription ends.
Yeah.
So it can be part of a kind of trajectory of drug use. Mm.
Yeah, so what kind of findings have emerged from the Attune Project so far?
I think there were several sort of overarching issues that have come out of it. I think one of the main findings that perhaps has surprised us was quite how heterogeneous the group was as a kind of group of substance users. We really had participants that came from all kinds of groups, so you know, we had single mothers, we had people in sort of full-time stable employment, we had ex-offenders. It really wasn't necessarily what you might describe as kind of a typical group of substance users. And I think that also reflects the fact that amphetamine type stimulants is this umbrella term, and it does cover what are a very varied group of substances that give quite different effects, and people use those substances for very different reasons. So we found, for example, that there were quite distinct groups of people who were using things like ecstasy for much more kind of pleasure seeking hedonism compared to the sort of standard amphetamines like speed or meth, and often that was much more kind of functional use, so using to cope with work, with life, with relationships.
And I would not have known that at all.
So that, I think that was one of the one big, was just how varied it is and how varied the pathways. I think the other important finding for us was how much, when we're talking about that quite functional use, that was around self-medicating, and that there were a lot, particularly of the very heavy end stimulant users, who were using it because they had quite severe depression and anxiety, obviously that is quite a kind of complex direction.
Yeah.
So you had people who were already diagnosed with mental health, ill health, who were using it to cope. But then on the other side, you have people whose mental health worsens and is exacerbated by the fact that they're using stimulants over a long period of time. So I think that in terms of the kind of implications for practice, that's one of the more important findings of our work.
What was interesting to me was that for some people there were real kind of vulnerabilities that led to longer term amphetamine use, and then for other people it seemed that there were various protective factors, or that they were only using amphetamines for a certain period of their lives. So for example, for partying and recreational drug use.
That's right, and certainly that was an issue that made it quite challenging for us to reach all the different kinds of participants we want to, because for a lot of people, drug use isn't something that they see as problematic or as difficult or as negative. It's part of it is part of pleasure seeking, of good times, of parties, of festivals. But for us, they often had quite a different sort of life story to tell than people who were using stimulants for these more kind of functional, often quite challenging reasons. And I think because of those different trajectories, they have, there's different issues there, and there's probably going to be different solutions over the long term, in terms of whether it's more about kind of harm reduction, just so just making sure that kind of pleasure seeking substance use stays relatively safe. Whereas for the more kind of long-term heavy functional users, they really need much more joined up substantial support.
Yeah, and was there a particular any themes around the demographics of people who were using amphetamines?
We found that we're at quite an early stage with the survey analysis, but we did find, maybe unsurprisingly, that people whose use became much heavier and problematic were starting at a much younger age.
That was really interesting.
And that compared with people who never use stimulants. So one of the groups that we were looking at were people who could have used stimulants. So, you know, they've been at a party where someone said, "Here, do you want to try some ecstasy?" But they've said no. And we wanted to know, well, what was it that made you say no?
I think that's really good that you've captured that as well.
Hard group to crack, but we found that obviously they didn't use stimulants, but in terms of any substance use, their initiation age was much higher than the other groups in our survey.
Yeah, and what were the patterns of use looking at the North and looking at other European countries?
We, again, still at a relatively early stage, so probably can't say too much in terms of the detail. In terms of the substance use itself, we know that methamphetamine, for example, much heavier use in Czech Republic and in Germany. It's a much bigger issue than it is in the Northeast. A lot of the people we spoke to, particularly in the interview stage, you know, methamphetamine's still quite, even for heavy drug users, it's seen as a much more kind of maybe extreme substance. It's more stigmatized.
Yes.
What has been interesting, I understand that Poland have got kind of the highest levels out of all of the countries of novel psychoactive substance use, which I wasn't necessarily expecting.
No.
I kind of thought it might be the North East. Although maybe that's partly because we were looking at stimulant use rather than synthetic cannabinoids, which we do know is a major problem in particularly kind of homeless and vulnerable populations in the North.
Yeah, I mean, talking about homeless and vulnerable populations, the presentation this afternoon was really interesting, wasn't it? And I think it's really good how you've kind of reached out to more socially excluded groups and included them in the research so that their voices are reflected along with everybody else's. But I've heard a lot about some of the challenges this afternoon, just around making sure that participation was trauma-informed. And I just wondered if you had any observations or thoughts around that in terms of research generally, maybe even.
The research team as a whole, I think, have a lot of relevant experience that they brought to the work. I think we did anticipate that, not just for the survey, but for the qualitative interviews, that asking people to talk about kind of long-term substance use and the events that have shaped that is potentially going to be triggering. So the people that we got involved had skills and experience that we thought would make them better able to deal with that. Because obviously it's traumatic for the participant, but it can be quite traumatic for the researcher too. So we went into it to some respect with kind of eyes open, and we had various support structures for both sides put in place early on. I think having said that, certainly some of the stories that we were told were probably, you know, more unexpectedly kind of traumatic than I think you could ever
expect,
predict.
And maybe those people haven't told the stories before.
Exactly.
So,
So yes, I think we'd done a lot to try and prepare ourselves as a team. But I certainly think we've learnt a huge amount about how we do this research and what the experience is like for the participant themselves.
Yeah.
And I think Mark's involvement from the People's Kitchen has been hugely valuable. And I certainly think that there are things we probably do differently
going
forward. You know, part of that is working even more closely with kind of peer researchers themselves.
Yeah, that seemed to be a theme today, didn't it? I know it's early days, but have you got any thoughts so far about implications for practice findings?
We heard today some fantastic ideas from across the room, because we had really fortunate enough to have a lot of people who are already working in the kinds of organisations that we're going to need to
definitely
work with to make the change. I think, again, coming back to this mental health theme, and I know this is an issue when it comes to lots of substances in my other sort of research field. I work more around kind of alcohol use disorder.
Right.
And the challenge of dealing with people who have coexisting substance use and mental health issues is one that we just haven't got on top of.
I would agree with that.
And I think that's an issue that I've heard in previous research, and it was a theme that came up over and over today, and in the kind of interviews and survey we did. I think somehow we have to get to the bottom of kind of joining up those two.
I agree, and not seeing them as separate,
people
falling through the gaps because we see them as separate and siloed. And
because the reality is, you know, the vast majority of people with really serious substance use are likely to have ongoing mental ill health too. It just does not make sense
to
separate these things out. So I think for me that's one of the biggest messages, and I think that links to more broadly this need for sort of joined up working across all the different kinds of agencies that stimulant users might possibly access for support, because we've heard from so many that they're unlikely to go to the standard drug treatment centres, but they maybe are coming into contact with housing associations or their GP or a social worker or a probation officer. There are lots of opportunities to provide kind of support and advice, and I think, again, this was something that was raised several times. You know, we've talked so long about multi-agency working, and, you know, we're now in this kind of new world of integrated care.
Yes.
And we're still really not
applying it.
Not applying it. We've
talking
haven't worked
it,
out how to do it best. The kind of the rules, regulations and structures don't support that way of
that's
working.
That's right,
And I think, I mean, that's a broader issue beyond,
but it's good that it can be raised, isn't it, through the research. And you know, my experience of working in prisons is still people are being excluded, you know, on the basis of the drug histories and the criminal justice histories, and it's got to change,
it
hasn't
really
it
has
and
to
people
change.
Have to be, you know, supported in a more holistic way, as much as we talk the talk about that. So
but it just doesn't happen. People are kind of medicalized and siloed, you know, and these are kind of rounded human beings with lives and a lot of difficult stuff going on. And only kind of addressing one dimension of that difficult stuff isn't going to be enough.
No, it's complex and messy, isn't it, for most people. Okay, any final thoughts? I know next week you're going to be in Lisbon, aren't you, as well?
Yes, so it's a tough job.
Yeah, I know, for you.
Final thoughts is I am really interested to hear what the European partners have to say. I think this is a very important topic within the UK, and I think in the North in particular. Yeah. But it would be good to see what we can learn maybe from outside the UK in terms of how we improve practice in this area. I think much as what we have done in this study has started to plug some of the evidence gaps.
Yeah.
Again, we heard today that there's so many unanswered questions. So
yeah.
I'd be interested in exploring opportunities for taking that research forward. And as we've really emphasised, in partnership with the kind of the users themselves and then the providers.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.